listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Spingola, and I'm broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs. I really appreciate you joining me today at republicbroadcasting.org. I also invite you to visit and subscribe to SpingolaSpeaks.net and ScreeningSandyHook.net. During the program, email questions or comments to comments@spingola.email. And I invite you to visit our chat room at spingola.chatango.com. And you know where the archives are for this program, and you know how to access the schedule page so that you can see who I've had on the program over the years since October of 2010. And all the links that are associated with each program are there. And so please feel free to visit those files. Our guest today is Greg Felton, F-E-L-T-O-N. He is the author of Exploding Middle East Myths, 15 Years of Fighting Zionist Propaganda, and The Host and the Parasite, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America. I interviewed Greg, believe it or not, on August 25th, 2011. I can't believe it's been that long. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you, Deanna. Yeah, it has been a long time.
I can't believe that I let you not, that I didn't have you back on. It's just amazing. Time goes by when
having fun, maybe, but for some other reasons.
For a lot of other reasons, I guess. Yeah. But I'm just really delighted that you could join me today. And Greg's website is gregfelton.com. And right. Do visit that website and read his book. And you've kind of reauthored the book. You've redone it. And it didn't start out as a book, right?
Well, actually, it did start out as a book, but it started out with a slightly different focus. It all began after the September the 11th attack or self-inflicted demolition of the World Trade Center. And what disturbed me more than anything else, besides the loss of life and the destruction of the buildings, was the hysterical blame casting of the media against Muslims and Osama bin Laden in particular. I knew enough about bin Laden to know that he did not have anything to do with the bombing or the attack on the World Trade Center. And it concerned me a great deal that the media was just regurgitating the most invidious prejudice and hate-mongering bigotry. And I realized that there was something severely wrong. Something just didn't smell right about it. And subsequent to my seeing the event or watching the event unfold on television, I came to realize that the video footage of it was not entirely, well, honest. And so I set about writing a book to talk about the life of Osama bin Laden. And I made every possible mistake a book author could make, since I had never written anything larger than my master's thesis at UBC. So I had structural problems. I had a lot of research. The more I researched, the more I found I needed to research. It's like pulling a thread of a sweater. It kept coming unraveled. And so I eventually had my first version done after the 2001 attack. It came out in 2007, I think. I mean, it was both a pleasure to write, but it was also aggravating to a degree I cannot possibly explain. Since that time, it's undergone two updates. One of them was to update the book to take into account the presidencies of Obama and Trump.
Oh,
as,
yes.
as it refers to the what I call the Zionization of America. See, my book, which you can find at moneytreepublishing.com, it's not exactly your standard history of America. Like, I don't go back to the Constitution. I don't look at the presidents on their own merits. I look at something beyond the surface of America, because I would imagine that most Americans looking at the country today do not recognize it from the country that emerged from World War II. Certainly not the Eisenhower-era America or the Civil Rights America of the 1960s and early 70s. There is something severely wrong with it. And my book is, I think, probably a psychiatric diagnosis of the country to understand the pathology of America and how it degenerated into one of the world's most repressive terroristic regimes, a country where the average American citizen is seeing the standard of living degenerate generation after generation, how a country has repudiated its own principles to such a degree that it can no longer be called a democracy, much less a republic. And so what I did was I looked at what is common to America. What is America doing that is most contrary to its vaunted principles of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, blah, 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 whatever James Madison wrote in the Constitution. Sorry, that was Jefferson in the Declaration. And I came to the realization that America has essentially abdicated control over its own country. And the person it abdicated it to was the State of Israel. And I went back and I looked at Israel had essentially bought its way into the White House and Congress dating before 1947, really, when the United States engaged in extortion, blackmail, and arm twisting to force the United Nations Security Council to approve the partition of Arab Palestine. And from that, I went off and I started digging more and more and more and ended up realizing that America does not exist. It's a zombie nation, a shell of a country that has all the trappings of a democracy, but none of the soul or the spirit or the integrity of a democracy. I mean, Jimmy Carter, former President Carter, stated that America is an oligarchy. That's true. That's a very accurate statement, but it's even more severe than that. America has become a neo-fascist police state. Now, I want to stop here a second and say I do not think it's fair for Americans to look at Donald Trump and blame all of their problems on him, thinking that the American Republic ended with Obama and then suddenly fell off a cliff. Donald Trump, as horrid, bloviating, immature, narcissistic, incompetent, and offensive as he may be, is not a sui generis problem. He is the end result of about 40 years of Zionist occupation of American politics. Because if you go back to the Ronald Reagan era, and this is going to sound odd, but there is an interesting bookending of the decline of the Republican Party, beginning with Reagan and ending with Trump. Now, inasmuch as those two men do not appear to have anything in common, one was a beloved great communicator, the other one is a loathsome embarrassment to himself and the country. Yet, there is a cause and effect. Because if you look at how Reagan behaved, Reagan was essentially unqualified to be president in many ways, but he gave the illusion of competence and he knew how to speak to people. Donald Trump is manifestly unqualified to lead the country, yet he has no concept of political discourse or how to present himself as a believable president. He is almost the negative almost the antithesis of Reagan, one positive, one negative, but both basically inept. And it's from Reagan's presidency onward that loyalty to Israel and subservience to neoconservative or neo-fascist economic, unenlightened economic self-interest or corporate welfareism became the standard, almost unquestionable status quo of the country. And because of that, anybody who had an America First policy, anybody who wanted to improve the lives of Americans, anybody who thought the Constitution had any value, was slowly pushed out of the party, ridiculed, marginalized, or just resigned. I mean, the last person to speak on behalf of Americans in this year was Bernie Sanders. And the Democrats are just as corrupt as the Republicans. And the last thing they want is somebody like Sanders, who's probably a throwback to the progressive era politics of Theodore Roosevelt. No one wanted him to upset the apple cart and take away their corporate lolly. I mean, the Democrats would just as soon lose to a Republican as to have a really genuine reformist Democrat lead the country. There's too much unraveling that would have to be done. Too many people would be embarrassed. Too many people would lose their perks. And so we have a country now that has nobody to speak for the American public. Americans have no one to vote for. They are a leaderless country. There is no government. There is a selfish occupation force that is primarily subservient to Israel, who gets $104 a second out of the American economy.
That doesn't include all of the groups in America that are collecting money for Israel. You're just talking about what the government itself gives.
That's right. Well, that's right. You look at all the non-monetary benefits, such as free trade agreements, compulsory purchases of Israeli products. Tax exempt status. For example,
the kosher tax,
right? Jared Kushner, who's essentially the governor of who's essentially president, right? Because Trump has essentially abdicated his role to play golf and make vacuous tweets. But Kushner gave something like 1 million face masks to Israel when Americans need just as much protection from viral contamination. Why does Israel get preference over America? There has not been an American government since, I would submit, George H.W. Bush. I'm not a fan of the Bush family, but at least George H.W. Bush, Reagan's vice president, understood the danger that the Pentagon Jews presented to the Republic. But after he was vilified by the Project for the New American Century, led by people like Paul Weyrich and Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, etc., everybody had been essentially Israel's lapdog. And America, as I said in my book, that was started on the slow decline into neo-fascism and subservience to Israel with Ronald Reagan. Now, Reagan himself did not have any Jews in his cabinet, but they were rife throughout the sub-levels of ministries. And by the time the mid-80s rolled around, it was too late. You know, American foreign policy in the Middle East was primarily about serving Israel, not about securing oil. And so now we have Donald Trump, and he started out playing.
Actually, he incorporated the PNAC principles. I wrote an article just after he was elected, he was elected by default. They didn't want another politician. Everybody detested Hillary. So he was just a shoo-in, because he wasn't a politician. And so I wrote an article shortly after he came in, and the name of the article is "We've Been Trumped." And he really endorsed all the PNAC, people, and even had them in his cabinet. And if you look at who funded him or who he put in charge of finance, you'll find Adelson on on the let me just bring it up here. So he's got all the same old people. Sheldon Adelson was his finance vice chair. If you look over all the people that he had, he was just really just bringing back PNAC.
Well, that's, you're perfectly correct. And as I, in my book, I got this one scene where I explained that Trump went up against something like a dozen and a half professional politicians, governors, senators, congressmen, and none of them was deemed credible enough to run up against, Barack Obama. Sorry, Hillary Clinton, pardon me. And I say all Trump had to do was step over the corpses to take the nomination. He didn't have to, compete for it. There was just nobody there who was even remotely electable. What, Tom Cruise? Ted Cruz, please. I mean, it was embarrassing. Some of the things these people said were just horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And people said, look, we'll put our faith in this sort of TV host / real estate developer who doesn't look like he's terribly bright, but perhaps he couldn't do any worse than Clinton. And Clinton, of course, was unelectable because she was an unindicted war criminal.
A war criminal plus just civilians that kind of ran across her path. If you look at all of the body count, the Clinton body counts, oh my gosh.
You know, she actually went on TV and said, I would bomb Syria for Iran. I mean, here she actually almost, she was like prostituted herself to Israel's overarching Middle East posse. So you look at people saying, well, what happened to Libya? Why did we destroy a country, sadistically kill its leader?
Oh,
you may
terrible.
Not have liked him, but I mean,
terrible.
Clinton was a bankster senator. She gave three speeches to Goldman Sachs. She refused to divulge her scripts. I managed to get a hold of them. I mean, there was nothing about her that was likable. And in fact, her own campaign team was hearing reports from the public that none of them could warm up to her. And even Clinton said she didn't have much use for the average American. She was just there to, you know, to be a corporate representative.
Right.
Clinton was unelectable. And so there wasn't really so much an election in 2016 as there was a default coronation.
Right.
Now, yes. Leaving aside the fact that, you know, Clinton may have won the popular vote, she couldn't win where it counted. And that's the working class states of the Rust Belt.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Trump ended up winning more than Obama did percentage-wise in those states. So what we had was we did not have Trump elected president. We had a rejection of the coronation of Hillary Clinton.
Exactly.
And that's the big problem. Now, the fact is people voted strategically in 2016 for good reason. But now they've got the sort of buyer's remorse. You've got this horrible man-child playing silly bugger in the White House, making tweets about things he doesn't understand, stating the first thing that comes to mind and believing it to be true. I do think Trump is mentally unfit to govern. There's certain psychological behaviors he is showing that are extremely disturbing.
Exactly. I read the book by his niece, Mary Trump, and while it was kind of a screed to some extent, mm-hmm. She gave a background of the family that he grew up in, and there were five children, and the father was just into money. He had no time for the children. The wife was chronically ill. The children just sort of grew up on their own, and I think that, well, his father was a narcissistic person. He was, they had a lot of money, but there was no love. There was just, it was just really, really a sad situation in which he grew up. Yeah. But the father, Fred, favored Donald and got him out. He bailed him out by the millions and millions of dollars. And Donald Trump is not really the business tycoon that everybody thinks he is.
That's right.
Because he invested in things that he should never have invested in. He should have stayed with what his father was doing because it provided a steady income, where Donald Trump invested in gambling and casinos and things that he was a flop as a business person. And, gosh.
Well, I saw a very interesting show about Trump where he was discussing with one of his closest business advisors or partners about Atlantic City. And he wanted to build this huge, gigantic enterprise on Atlantic City, in Atlantic City. And his friend said, not a good idea, Donald. We should rethink about this. And Trump's response was, you have no vision.
We do have a quick 3-minute break.
Yep, okay.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead.
All right, we are back. And our guest is Greg Felton. And we were talking about Donald Trump and Atlantic City. And you're right. He's the next reality TV star, and he probably did a really good job. I didn't ever watch that program. I've watched TV since March, but I'm sure that he may have been successful there. But anyway, pick it up where you left off.
Yeah, I just remember seeing the show where he was told that he couldn't afford to do this. It was too big a gamble. Because he had to borrow heavily.
Right.
And he became so indebted to the banks that he ceased to be an independent businessman. Like, he was essentially in hock up to his eyes. And whatever the banks told him to do, he had to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so Trump is, I don't know what it is about him, but he thinks if he gets an idea, and he thinks so highly of himself that he couldn't be wrong. He has a narcissistic complex, which which makes it hard for him, A, to admit he's wrong, B, to accept advice from people who know more than he does. I mean, I want to talk just for a minute about his claim that the election could be postponed beyond November the 3rd. I saw the tweet about that, and I've seen all the extreme negative reaction, Democrat, Republican, Independent, everybody saying that Trump is a constitutional time bomb waiting to go off. Even the Federalist Society, which has certain questionable points of view, is so far so conservative that they refuse to endorse Trump. So somehow Trump has managed to alienate whatever is perhaps remaining of his political power base outside of the Deep South.
I don't understand these people that are so, they love him. What is wrong with these people?
Well, first of all, I want to say one thing about the election. I don't think Trump was being entirely serious. I think he is so worried about mail-in votes being anti-Trump that he allowed himself to run off at the mouth and say something stupid. Now, if he genuinely believed that the election should be postponed, he had to know that it's not within his power to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Trump can't do that, so this was just like a stupid, stupid comment. It's up to Congress to determine the electoral date. And it's fixed according to a certain schedule. Like, even in Canada now, we have a fixed election date, which is like October the 19th every 4 years. So even if Trump said that, which is repugnant, it doesn't really mean anything. I mean, he can't back up his mouth with any action. So a lot of people are making more of this than they should be. The problem is Trump is his own worst enemy. All the Democrats have to do is hope that Joe Biden maintains a pulse, and they will walk into the White House. Now, that might not be as certain as it looks. I mean, Biden's got his own mental aberrations which call into question his fitness for office, too.
Right.
It'll determine whether people are more afraid of Biden or Trump and how much they can afford to hold their nose when they go into the ballot box. But the thing with Trump is that he just is so ridiculous that it doesn't really pay to take him at face value. I saw one good article in The Atlantic. There was a great line that Trump's detractors take him at face value, but don't take him seriously. Trump's supporters don't take him at face value and do take him seriously. So what that means is Trump's supporters, they will make allowances for his rather inept verbiage. Oh, he didn't mean that, or he was referring to this. They will sort of cognitively distance themselves from whatever Trump is saying. But you'll notice the people who really like Trump are dyed-in-the-wool Southern bigots who hate anything that smacks of interference with American individualism or public spending. And Trump sort of appeals to kind of the a certain uneducated mass of people who have a visceral dislike for federal politics. And Trump, as an outsider, is sort of an anti-politician, as you mentioned earlier. So Trump appeals to viscerally appeals to a core group of people, maybe 20-30% of the population, of the voting bloc, I don't know. But the problem for Trump is that he can't appeal beyond that anymore. His core supporters are repugnant to most Americans. And that support is going to be the biggest reason, I think, that people are going to vote Biden. Even Republicans are going to abandon their party and vote for the Democrats, I don't know if it'll be the end of the Republican Party, because throughout American history, parties have come and gone. There was the Democratic Republicans, then there were the Whigs. The Whigs gave way to other people. Then the Republicans started in 1954, and Lincoln became its first president, and blah, blah, blah. There were progressive parties, and there's like an accordion effect of party unity and party dissolution in American history. So maybe the Republicans might have to redefine themselves. But for Trump, though, for Trump's supporters, they like the simplistic or simple-minded kind of good old boy attitude, because Trump appeals to the bigoted mentality throughout the American Deep South, I think.
That's kind of what I thought, too, except that there are some – I'm on Twitter. It's the only a social media that I participate in. But it seems to me, and there are people who I have followed and who are bright and intelligent and they like him. And I think, have you become brain dead? It's just amazing to me that these really smart people are promoting him. I don't get it.
It is a mystery. I mean, educated people should know better. But again, you have people who come to politics with more prejudice than principle. I assume that the people who you're talking about would not vote Democrat because they're not in favor of public spending. They're not in favor of civil rights or legislation to attenuate prejudice against, say, Hispanics or blacks or women, or there are people who don't like the sort of slavish obedience to homosexual or transsexual politics or identity politics. I think they see Trump as an unadorned sort of in your face. This is the kind of what you get when you get Trump kind of person. And I kind of think it appeals to their basic biases against government. Now, as I say, you're quite right. It's not just the Southern types who like Trump. He does have a support base outside of it, but I would submit that it's smaller. I mean, when push comes to shove, we're going to see a lot of people who are educated recognize that Trump is more trouble than he's worth, and that Biden, for all of his infirmity and all of his rather empty rhetoric, would probably be a better choice. You have a choice between someone like Trump, who's mentally unbalanced, or someone like Biden, who's maybe mentally unqualified. I don't know if that's even a fair distinction, but that's what we kind of
here's
have
what
here.
I think. I think that it's just my thoughts. That Obama is going for a third term, and that if Biden is elected, then Obama will actually run things behind the scenes.
That's not a bad idea. That's not bad at all.
Well, I don't know, the way that the United States has gone in the last, well, I go back further with my history and research and whatnot, has been in very deep trouble for a very long time. And, gosh, it's just, I don't know whether anybody has the ability to pull it back to stop sending money abroad and start taking care of the infrastructure here at home and start getting the lead out of the water in Flint, Michigan and taking care of the bridges that are falling down. We need to be taking care of our citizens and really doing what we need to be doing here at home,
right,
and get out of the Middle East.
Well, that's an excellent idea, and I don't think anybody would really disagree with you. But the problem is that is the contagion of Zionism and Israeli firstism and the intimidation, the bullying, and the coercive effect of Israeli agents in America is so pervasive and has metastasized like a cancer throughout the entire country, that it's going to be very difficult to find anybody who can turn the state around without being assassinated. Now, what I noticed in the last chapter of my book, when I talk about Obama and Trump, you'll notice that Obama is not some sort of great reformer that followed W. He became part of the same institutionalized Israel first
right.
infrastructure. And even though Obama did stand up to Netanyahu once or twice, it was essentially the behavior of a disaffected loyal satrap who got uppity against the emperor, and the emperor had to come over and sort of chastise him and spank him publicly and then go off back home. I wrote a rather fun little satire about that in the form of a children's story time reading. It was one of my favorite things I wrote about how, you know, the great emperor, the Zionis came over to America and then they took revenge, or they punished the local leader for daring to stand up to the imperial edicts. But the thing with Trump and Obama is that they don't really show any real difference from what came before them. They are a continuation of the Zionization of America, and I do not believe, I hate to say this, but I do not believe that the United States can be reformed. I think it has to be destroyed and reconstituted. Now, I cannot see a non-Zionist president being elected, freezing all Israeli assets, expelling the Israeli embassy, declaring war on Israel, and shutting down all trade with Israel. Because Israel has the Congress by the balls. And all it has to do is squeeze tight enough and the Congress will obey.
Mm-hmm.
America has sold itself out.
Well, you really can't even run for office, for federal office, public office in this country unless you have support from Israel.
Right.
And what was that letter that Hillary Clinton sent out when she was Secretary of State? There were 300 congresspeople that signed up to be supporters of Israel. And there are a lot of people with dual citizenship. It is terrible. And you have to think, well, how in heaven's name did they get their meat hooks into so many people in this country? And it all boils down to money and money and money. But what else? I don't understand.
Well, speaking of letters, I mean, former Representative Cynthia McKinney lost her seat in Congress because she refused to sign a loyalty oath to Israel.
Absolutely.
Which means that every sitting congressman and senator, signed. Representative and senator, is guilty of treason.
If they
signed that document. So how can you correct a treasonous legislature?
Right.
To act in the American interest. You can't. You have to get rid of these people. And I do not see an evolutionary way around this. Now, I'm not advocating civil war in America, but it would not surprise me if certain states had had enough of the Jewish occupation, had enough of having their country prostituted to a foreign entity that is neither legitimate morally, politically, or even conceptually. Israel is an illegitimate country. Because of that, I don't know how Americans can, whether they've been so beaten down and humiliated and intimidated and emasculated, like the people who live in George Orwell's 1984, I don't know. But somebody has to do something. There has to be some sort of an emotional, visceral, public uprising to either overthrow the government or to demand secession of certain states from the republic. I do not see another way out of this, and I would like to say I could. But how do you reform a country that's so cancer-ridden? I mean, even a cancer patient at some point finds that the cancer is inoperable. If it gets into your bones, you can't operate bone cancer. And America has political bone cancer.
Well, it incorporates a lot of other aspects of American culture, because the churches were taken over a long time ago. Seminaries were taken over. Rockefeller took over a lot of the seminaries, and they were teaching that the Scofield Bible. And when you go back and look at what the seminaries have been teaching, the churches, and what the churches are promoting, saying, well, Israel is, you know, the Jewish people are God's chosen people, and we need to support Israel, and we need to do this and that. And so it isn't just a political question. It's also a religious issue, because you have so many people who do not understand. And the other thing, too, is the actual people who call themselves Jews. If you go back in history, it's about 800 AD, then you find that the people that call themselves Jews are really not Jews at all. They're Khazars.
Well, hang on. Be very careful, though. You're partly right. The word Jew is not an ethnic term. It's a religious term. So the Khazars...
They use it for both.
But they can't. And this is the great lie of Zionism. The Jews present themselves as a people, and they demand protection like a Slav, a Balt, a Latin, a Greek, a Russian, a Chinese, anybody. But they can't do that. The idea that Jews represent an ethnic group is common to only two groups of people in the world. One are Zionist Jews and German fascists. Because the whole term of anti-Semitism, which is a nonsense term, dates only to 1873. And by a man named Wilhelm Marr, who was a German bigot. And he just came up with a term to categorize Jews that went beyond the fundamental religious definition. Now, somebody can be a Jew and then simply renounce their religion. It's not going to change their DNA. They will still be the same person, but they may follow a different church or a different... A friend of mine, Gilad Atzmon, in England, was born in Israel. Mm-hmm. But he considers himself a Palestinian. He has renounced his Zionist Judaism. Mm-hmm. So he's still alive. The place he was born is still there. He is still a Palestinian by birth, but he's not Jewish, and I can respect that. Some people are Catholics, but they find a Jewish lover, and they marry them, and they adopt Judaism. So they become a Jew by adoption. It doesn't make them any less Jewish. So the Khazars, who under Kagan Bulan in around early first half of the 8th century, had a mass conversion to Judaism. Now, that just proves that the Khazarian Jews, which are the origin of the Ashkenazim, the German Jews of Europe, they are not Hebraic. They are not Middle Eastern. So they have absolutely no connection whatever to the Israel that we find in the Torah,
exactly,
the Tanakh, or even in the New Testament. So these people are Jews by adoption. They're not Jews by birth.
Mm-hmm.
And to say by birth, I mean they weren't Hebraic born into a Jewishly religious family. But
right.
It is fundamental for Americans to accept the fact that Jews are not a people. The Jews have no right to claim they are God's chosen people, Harry Potter. You know, it just doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
All you are is a religious group. I could adopt Judaism if I wished. and I would become a Jew, which I'm not. But that would make me no less a Jew than somebody who was born into a family of Jews. So the fact that the Zionists the Christians that you're talking about, the Scofield Bible Christians, the eccentric, off-the-wall, nutso Christians, these are Christians who buy into the cult of Zionism. And these are not standard Christians. And these are the only people who give the Zionist Jews the time of day. Because without the Christian Zionist, Israel would have no influence, or very little influence in America.
Mm-hmm.
Because inasmuch as the Zionist Jews are the origin and the cause of the degeneration of the United States, they need the acolytes, the useful idiots, the fawning admirers, say, like Jerry Falwell and Paul Weyrich, mm-hmm. and Oral Roberts.
Well, it's not just people on TV. It's other
yes.
religious faiths.
The Mormon Church
is very pro-Israel, and they have a lot of people in that church. So then you mentioned the degeneration. In what way is that? Through the media? Are you talking about the media?
Well, I would say partly the media, but don't forget Christian Zionists also populate the Congress. I mean, it was under Jimmy Carter's presidency that because he was a Baptist, that a lot of Christians came out in support of Israel. It became acceptable to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Just as after 1967, when Israel attacked Egypt, a lot of Jews could say, hey, we can be both pro-Israel and pro-America now. It's safe. Because up until that time, no Jew would say, I support Israel. Because that would have meant that Jews might be considered somewhat less American than a non-Jewish American. Jews were very self-conscious about the World War II experience, about trying to be considered
American. The alleged World War II.
I think World War II did happen. I mean, that's...
Oh, yeah, World War II did happen, but there's a lot of things that they say happened during World War II that did not happen.
Yeah, there's a lot of propaganda attending that. That is true. I don't want to get too wrapped up in that because I think that'll take us way off topic.
Right, yes.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're quite true about that. But with the rise of the Six-Day War, which was a six-day attack...
Oh, terrible.
Israelis, Jews came out of the woodwork and became openly Jewish, openly Israeli and American, because America and Israel were at least perceived to be on the same side. Now, even though Lyndon Johnson allowed USS Liberty to be attacked, many soldiers were wounded and killed, and Israel engaged in unprovoked warfare against America, and America did nothing to defend their soldiers. They did nothing to hold Israel accountable.
Well, the politicians did nothing because the average American didn't know about the USS Liberty.
And still don't. There is a book written about it, I know, that talks
exactly.
about it.
Exactly.
But Americans collectively, unfortunately, are pathologically ignorant of much of their own history because what they know is only what they've been officially told by movies and by propaganda media. I mean, I would imagine that most Americans have very little, cannot name the presidents in order of their own country. They do not know that Israel has no legitimacy, that the partition of Israel, of Palestine, I mean, was never approved. It was done by a GA resolution, General Assembly Resolution 181. It was never ratified. And President Truman deliberately did not ratify it because he did not want America to go down in history as being a country that sanctioned a war crime against Palestinian Arabs, which he knew was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, Israel has no political legitimacy. But you can't tell that to Americans who have been brought up on the cult of Jewish exceptionalism, the Holocaust myth, and a whole bunch of other things. So the tragedy of Americans, if they want their country back, they have to learn history not from American sources, but from sources that aren't biased in favor of the victors. They need to read all aspects of history, even things that they might find offensive. For them, to a large extent, America's view of history is very religious. it's very binary. There's black and white. There's good. There's the bad guys and the good guys. And how these two sides are apportioned depends upon whose political interests are being served. And Israel will not allow anybody to claim that they were victims of a Holocaust, because that's a word that they've appropriated for themselves. So which is why the Armenians, who claim the Turks committed a Holocaust in 1915 or so, they don't have the right to call themselves that. So history is being pigeonholed into certain categories that serve the political interests of a definable group. Mm-hmm. And this definable group is so effective at propagating its point of view that most Americans have no concept of any alternate reality. And so when you have a country that's been kept in the dark about what has really been going on, it's very hard to hope that there could be any meaningful reform, because the first stage of reform is education. And education is dangerous to people who want the public to remain ignorant.
Right. And of course, the education is, it used to be locally controlled, and now it's federally controlled. And, yes. It was taken over such a long time ago by the Rockefellers and Carnegie. And then you have the movie industry, which promotes, well, when you look at some of the things that they have promoted, and people actually believe these movies to be fact when they're not.
No, and the whole point of, as a matter of fact, there's a very good article I have about Hollywood wartime movies. That when a movie producer wants the Pentagon's help to stage.
All right.
The Pentagon sends a consultant who has control over the script,
right.
Rewrite authority, final cut approval. Every time the Pentagon is used to help shoot a movie, and of course the Pentagon gives itself to the movie producer free of charge.
Right.
And the Pentagon makes sure that everything that's made in that movie is an advertisement for the military.
And that's your book.
That part is not in my book. That's something that I want to write about that a bit later.
Okay.
But it is true, though, that the Pentagon takes control of movies, and if the movie producer will not allow the Pentagon to rewrite the history, then the Pentagon runs away, and the people are on the hook for God knows how many tens of millions of dollars. So the Pentagon, no film about military history in America can be taken at face value if the Pentagon has been involved. It must be determined to be propaganda.
Right.
And that's I
read a lot about this just in this week. I read 3 or 4 books at a time. And yes, that what you're saying is absolutely true. When the Pentagon is involved, they get the movie producers get all of these extras, because they actually use the military. They use the military bases. They use the military airplanes, like Top Gun. Was that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that. Okay, we're going to a quick 3-minute break right now. All righty. We are back with our guest, Greg Felton, and he is the author. Actually, you've kind of rewritten your book, but you are the author of The Host and the Parasite, which I am reading. And The Host and the Parasite, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America. And in Chapter 10, it says One Nation Under PNAC. And that's, I found that very interesting. Okay.
I have a lot of fun doing my chapter headings and things like that. I'm a headline writer from way back. I just have fun with words.
Yeah, I thought that was really good. One Nation.
Thank you very much. I want to come, I'll be with one last second. People who want to look about the Pentagon appropriating Hollywood for propaganda purposes should pick up a book called Operation Hollywood, How the Pentagon Shapes and Censors the Movies.
Is by that David, Mark Dice?
No, by David L. Robb, R-O-B-B.
Okay.
It's put out in 2011, April 29th. And it shows just how much control the Pentagon uses over the movie industry. The movie industry basically is sold out to the Pentagon, because they don't want to spend money to make movies, so they want so you get what you pay for. You want something free? Well, what's the cost of getting free military support? You lose your integrity.
Right.
And by the way, so we're talking about, you're talking about the One Nation Under PNAC. That is, I had fun with that title because PNAC represents the ratcheting up of the fascist control of America. Up until then, it had become almost proto-fascist, not formally, but it was leaning that way. And so you have the Christian Zionists, the Jewish Zionists, and other sort of right-wing zealots taking over, forming a cabal, much the way that the Nazis did in Germany, the Bolsheviks did in Russia, a small little cluster of dedicated reformers, dedicated true believers, imposed themselves on the majority, which was unable to resist them. And that's what we have today. We have PNAC America. We don't have a constitutional state. As I say in my last chapter, which I think is one of the nicest things about my book, and I don't mean to sound self-promotional, but the one thing I do like about my book is that I came up with a metaphor from an allusion to the movie The Matrix, which talks about what people see and what reality is and what appearance is. And I came to the conclusion that if you look at the world as being rational and you try to explain irrational acts in the context of a rational world order, it's impossible because something just doesn't make sense. You can't explain, for example, why the United States bombed Afghanistan in 2001, because Afghanistan had no targets worth bombing. And Donald Rumsfeld even said so. Why the hell are we bombing Afghanistan? We want to bomb Iraq. Well, geez, why would you bomb Iraq? What did that have to do with the World Trade Center? Nothing. But he wanted to bomb Iraq for other reasons and needed an excuse to do so, which is what the World Trade Center attack gave America. But no, you had to go to Afghanistan because that's where bin Laden was. And of course, we all believe bin Laden was responsible, even though the report did not say that and barely even mentioned bin Laden. So right. There had to be another reason for it.
And well, Clinton was really pushing the bin Laden thing. And he talked about it all the time, was really pushing it. And anyway, we'll pick this up on the other side of the top of the hour. We'll pick it up on the other side. Be right back.
Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back, Susanna. And we have as our guest today Greg Felton, and he is the author of The Host and the Parasite, and he recently rewrote it, and the publisher is moneytreepublishing.com, and I think that everyone should visit that site, as well as Greg's site, which is gregfelton.com.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Deanna. You were interesting about Clinton earlier, about him making a big deal out of bin Laden. Mm-hmm. In my book, I have a chapter about Clinton, in which I call him, see, Clinton, that would be the sixth. The chapter six is called Jewish Presidency. Now, I say that not because Clinton was Jewish, but because he was the first president to sell himself out to Israel before he got sworn in. Clinton managed to give Israel so many billion dollars worth of tribute, promised tribute before he got elected. And so by the time he gets sworn in, he's essentially Israel's man in the White House. And throughout the 1990s, we had a very weird set of foreign policy decisions, as I say, which only makes sense if you change your frame of reference. Now, before the break, I was saying that if you assume the world is as it looks and it's rational, that cause and effect have meaning, that America is a democracy, the president is elected by the public, and that policy is being made in the national interest, then what Clinton did makes no sense. Why would you have no-fly zones over Iraq? Why would you cause the death of 500,000 Iraqi children from starvation? Why would your Jewish Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, rationalize this? I have an interview with her in the book about why she thinks it's a good price to pay. Well, only a Zionist Jew could think so little of other people's lives.
Right. Leslie Stahl interviewed her.
And I have an excerpt from Stahl's interview in my book.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what makes me wonder about this is, in the last chapter, I asked the reader to think about this. What if the world isn't as it seems, like the Matrix in the movie The Matrix? What if the world is irrational? And if the world is irrational, then there are people who have a vested interest in keeping it irrational. And that means policies that don't seem to make sense do make sense. Because if the United States is an irrational state, then serving Israel can be explained as a form of national policy. And this is exactly what happened in the 1990s. This was the period in which Israel took over, to a large extent, foreign policy, much more so than before. There was no reason for America to set no-fly zones or to co-opt the United Nations into approving them. There was no need for that at all. And because of that, most Americans don't realize just how horrible a president Clinton was. He looked like a nice guy, played saxophone, had a aw-shucks behavior, had a genius IQ. But he was bought and paid for. He was, like so many presidents, he had been co-opted to serve a foreign government. And throughout the 1990s, we see the ratcheting up of control. The proto-PNAC elements start to coalesce. And by the time the mid-90s rolls around, you can see that the Zionist control of American foreign policy is becoming more and more pronounced. Now, Clinton needed bin Laden for one very good reason. He needed a great villain to justify military mm-hmm. overreach. And, right. Now, I'm a pack rat. I collect information over years, and I file it away, and I have this wonderful store of information. But, Murphy's Law being unrepealable, the one thing I did not manage to archive was a statement by Clinton, and I know he said it, that he needed bin Laden to be a supervillain.
Right. He did say that.
And I can't find the sort of, if you can send it to me, I would be grateful. I'd be very grateful. But, so he had to elevate bin Laden into the level of a supervillain, like a devil figure, to justify the sort of good Christian response to evil, which is why American policy is so binary. There's no nuance of meaning. There's no rational discussion of what we should or should not do. There's no political end game. There's no evaluation of cause and effect. The only reason to go after bin Laden was that bin Laden was a devout Muslim.
Right.
Bin Laden was a good guy, in my view. I think he was an intelligent, decent, moral man. But he had had enough of the sellout of his corrupt royal family to the Americans and to the Israelis. And he wanted to do something about it. Now, he was a military adventurer, but that shouldn't surprise Americans, because how many of their founding fathers were military revolutionaries? I mean, what was bin Laden except an Islamic revolutionary? So we adopt this horrible vocabulary of bias about Islamic terrorism or radicalization or bin Laden this and bin Laden that.
Well,
this is what happened in the 1990s, and it made it possible for the United States to make Islam the great devil, the devil enemy that justified the military. Go ahead.
During the 1980s and about 1985, the University of Kansas put out a lot of books to radicalize the Muslims, and they were put out for the Muslims and shipped to Iraq and to Afghanistan. And this was under George H.W. Bush. And it was his deal. And so they radicalized these people. And it's very interesting too that when they respond, when the United States goes in and bombs, it's a military action. But when they respond, it's terrorism. No, it is self-defense. They are defending their country. But America media calls it terrorism. No, they're defending their country.
That's a perfectly good observation. I'm glad you brought that up. Because terrorism, by definition, cannot be committed by people. It can only be committed by governments. Because terrorism is the act of using coercion, murder, or any other threat to compel people to behave in a certain way. Stalin used it in his country. People had to, could not challenge his policies. China uses it today to keep people in line. The Nazis used terrorism against their own people. To this day, the United States uses terrorism. People who criticize the government can be arrested. If you challenge the absolute veracity of 6 million dead Jews in World War II, you can be terrorized into occupational oblivion. You can be assailed. You can be killed. I mean, terrorism only applies to governments. And you are perfectly correct. Muslims who are defending themselves cannot be called terrorists. Even somebody who sets off a bomb in some shopping center in the United States is not a terrorist. He's just a bomber. Because the whole point of terrorism is to compel the victim to behave in a certain way. And there is no possible scenario in which you can tell me that a Muslim who blows up somebody or has a suicide bombing mission is trying to compel the victim to behave in a certain way. It's an act of frustration and desperation. In fact, suicide bombing should be called sacrifice bombing because they're sacrificing themselves to alert the world to what's going on. I was satirized in National Review for saying that, and I thought that was quite an honor.
It's also very interesting, that the war on terror, how ridiculous, and Bush named it the war on terror, which could be anything. He opened the gate that they could bomb anybody or do anything because they were preventing terror, when in fact it's the U.S. military that was terrorizing the Middle, that is terrorizing to this day the Middle East.
You're perfectly right. The word terrorism has no value. It's an empty rhetorical brickbat. Mm-hmm. The same way anti-Semitism is an empty word. Terrorism is an empty word. Islamic militant is an empty word. I mean, these are all buzzwords. These are all designed to short-circuit critical thinking. Mm-hmm. Which is why when this happens in a state like the United States, we end up at a scenario where the political culture is irrational. And if you understand it's irrational, then the public can say, well, why is it irrational? Who made it irrational? And how can we take action against these people? And this is what Americans have to wake up to. They have to stop pretending that they live in a democracy. They have to stop pretending that their individual rights are the most important thing in the world. Well, no, it's the country that's the most important thing. A lot of Americans have to coalesce around somebody who can launch a popular movement to do something about the degeneration, about the disconnect, between the American voter and the American legislature. And that is really the great challenge America faces. If that can be corrected, then some sort of reform is possible. But as I said earlier, I am doubtful that such a reform is possible because the Zionist cancer is metastasized throughout all aspects of society, education, industry, government, military, state, local authorities. AIPAC has offices in every state.
Mm-hmm. And they should register as a foreign...
It's a foreign entity. Yeah, but if you do that, it means they become accountable for what they say and do. And the Zionist Jews cannot afford to be accountable. You know, there is no formal treaty between the United States and Israel? Because if you sign a treaty, you sign mutual obligation. And
We have signed we have signed agreements to take their food products and that kind of thing. We have.
But that's it's not a treaty, it's an agreement.
Right.
Yeah. But you see, Israel will never put in writing what it wants to do. It has to be like a gangster state. I mean, the gangsters don't put anything in writing. Everything is done on cash basis. There's no record. It's all very, very informal. And you look at someone like Pompeo, who's good grief. He looks like somebody on a central casting for a Francis Ford Coppola Godfather movie. And he behaves like it too.
Well, just recently, this week, he all but called a cold war or a war against China.
Of course. China is the great distraction.
Right.
People will like Trump. This is perhaps why your friends like Trump. He's standing up to China. He's saying, no, China is the enemy. China is taking our jobs. China is threatening human rights. We are too, but we're not going to say that. And so people look at Trump as being a strong, self-assured president, when in fact this whole thing is just a sideshow.
Mm-hmm.
China may be a horribly autocratic regime, and its conduct in Hong Kong might be unconscionable by Western standards. However, the trade war that started all this was entirely America's doing.
Right.
China did nothing
wrong.
In the 70s. Yeah, but the thing is, if there's going to be a trade war, why is it that American businesses went over to China to set up factories?
Exactly.
To export jobs instead of having Americans work at home and earning decent salaries, pay a Chinese cents on the dollar to put out the same products. American business created the trade war.
Right, and that was way before NAFTA even came into being.
Right.
And this happened. I think Rockefeller had something to do with it, but they went over in 1973 or thereabouts, and they decided, there's no environmental protection agency over here. We can come over to China. We can get all this cheap labor. Cheap labor. There are a lot of people over there, and China is now, Beijing, at least when I was there, you actually did have to wear a mask because the air was so foul by noon that you could barely breathe. It was so bad because of all the smog, all the industrial stuff that was going on. It was terrible.
And you know, the irony is that because of this COVID virus, I mean, an economy shut down, the air over at Beijing is now breathable.
Yikes.
In fact, the air in Asia, there has been so much, the environment is so much cleaner that if we have this shutdown going on for another 50 years, the earth might recover. And that's kind of a weird thing to say, but if you think about that, man is the most, it's an exploitative animal that provides no benefit to the natural world. And if you take away the exploiter for any length of time, the world will recover. But as far as China goes, I mean, China did nothing more than what it was allowed to do by the Americans.
Right.
The fact that America as an imperial power does not go gently into that good night. It is not going to allow China to usurp America's place as the dominant economic power in the world. And so America needs some excuse to go to war with it to one degree or another, whether it's a shooting war, whether it's an economic war. America has to sort of pull China back. And so this whole war is essentially a great big playground pushing match between a bully, the United States, and a much bigger bully, China, and the United States is going to get its nose bloodied something fierce. Mm-hmm. Because at this point, China owns so much of America's external debt. I think it's one-third of all outstanding federal debt is owned by China. China could dump all of that on the open market and send the United States dollar down to the level of a Turkish lira.
Mm-hmm.
And so China has so much power. America has very little. It just has bluster and bombast.
Right.
And if the United States sends the seventh fleet, or is it the third fleet, into the Pacific, and they want to take on China, good luck to them. China will clobber them. I mean, America does not want to get into a shooting war, but America cannot allow itself to be seen as anything other than the best of the best. And it's American exceptionalism, the conceit that America is somehow better than anybody else, that drives its ego to take such irrational, to such irrational extremes. There was one goofball on TV, I forget his name. He was some sort of COVID-19 advisor or something. And he said about Canada, about the Canadian government wanting to keep the border closed to Americans for about a month longer. And he said something that, well, who the hell would want to go to Canada anyway? We're the best country in the world. What kind of a comment is that? I mean, why is America the best country in the world? I mean, I would think that people living in Finland or Denmark or even Canada, hey, let's say Canada, my own country for that matter, we think that we have a better country than the United States, and we can cite chapter and verse on various aspects of our life that is better than that offered to Americans. So you have the sheer infantile, juvenile conceit of the American government, American business, thinking that, oh, we cannot allow ourselves to become second. So we pick a fight. And it's a fight America can't win. But Americans who do think America is the be-all and end-all of human existence see this, hey, we got this Trump guy setting up to China. Hey, go Donnie, go Donnie.
So he's the perfect president for a narcissistic country.
He is, yeah.
Actually, I think I would prefer to be living in Sweden right now.
I would too. I would prefer Sweden or Norway or Finland.
Well, Sweden is, they didn't close down at all. They've been just doing fine. There's no COVID problems, no mask, no shut-in, no house arrest. It's perfectly fine. And if these tests, these COVID tests are, some of the swabs weren't even used, but they came back positive.
How is that possible?
Well, it really isn't, because if you have had a cold, you're going to test positive for COVID.
Well, it depends. You know, that all depends. COVID viruses, by and large, are very weak. They mm-hmm. do not. COVID viruses are very weak viruses. They're not very severe. You don't get very sick with them.
No.
Now, the difference is that SARS and SARS-CoV-2 is what we have now. These are sort of juiced up versions of COVID viruses. Now, I'm writing a book right now on the virus, and I have reasonable evidence, I mean compelling evidence, to show that it was manufactured in a laboratory, that there's no possible way beyond any reasonable doubt that the virus could have mutated on its own. It's just not feasible.
Dr. Mikovits would agree with you completely. Okay, we're going to a 3-minute break. We'll be right back.
Starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony.
Back. Our guest today is Greg Felton, and he is the author of The Host and the Parasite. We've been talking about that book. And you mentioned right before we went to the break about a book that you're writing about the manufactured germ. And I mentioned Dr. Judy Mikovits, mm-hmm. who knows about Fort Detrick, where a lot of bioweapons were developed. And you can also think back to the SV-40, where they used monkey kidneys to develop the polio vaccine, then you had cancer. A lot of people got cancer because they used these monkey kidneys. And so, and you're right. I think that you're onto something. Absolutely.
No, I can't speak to the monkey kidney issue, but I'm just noticing that, and I'm looking at the biochemical composition of SARS-CoV-2 without relying on someone like Mikovits or some other opinion. I'm doing my own research into the structure of how the virus is literally 10 to 20 times more virulent than SARS in 2002-2003. And there's a reason that it is fundamentally more virulent. And although one could make the theoretical argument that it happened as a matter of natural evolution, it strains credulity to the breaking point, because the odds of it happening are almost impossible. And I don't want to get too much into this because I have to finish a part of this by the middle of the month. I'm putting out two articles and I'm going to write four more and I'm going to combine all of them into a book. But the virus was probably funded by the United States. When Barack Obama in 2015 shut down what's called gain-of-function research, which is like weaponizing a virus, for the admittedly absurd reason of finding a way to defeat it should it ever get into the general population, which is kind of like telling arsonists to go burn down us. It's like setting a city on fire with accelerants and then telling a bunch of fire departments to go put it out as a form of practice. You don't start a fire and then call attention to it and put it out and call yourself a hero. Well, this is what we're doing with viruses. And I'm going to be investigating the degree to which this represented a bioweapon or did not represent a bioweapon. I'm looking at all the arguments in favor and against it. And I'm looking at how the United States played into this, because, as you know, from the University of North Carolina, Fort Detrick, and all this stuff, they stopped doing all this gain-of-function research, this weaponizing, and they sent it off to China. Let the Chinese take the risk. And they sent off this guy Lieber, this Dr. Lieber from Harvard, to oversee this whole thing. And, you know, you've got to wonder what the role of the United States is in all this. Again, this is something I'm researching. I don't want to get too deeply into it. But I have to tell you, it's been a fascinating education in how viruses infect bodies.
Just a question from the chat room. Mm-hmm. If this is a lab-modified virus, why would they create something which so far appears less dangerous than seasonal flu, which has killed many, many more people in previous years?
Well, that question is not very, very accurate. You cannot compare SARS-CoV-2 to a seasonal flu. That's just not possible. And I would submit that people who die from seasonal flu do not in any way have such, there's no seasonal flu that's quite so virulent as SARS-CoV-2. So I would reject the premise of the question.
Well, as a comparison, there are a lot of people that die of the flu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the flu can be found as a natural occurring disease. SARS-CoV-2, I'm going to argue, is
okay.
Not natural.
Okay.
And besides which, I don't believe you will find that if you compare flu to COVID-2, you end up diminishing the severity of what we have here. And you're drawing your attention away from how it came about. I mean, to be quite honest, if man had not been screwing around with the SARS, with the COVID, with the beta coronaviruses, none of this would have happened. This is a man-made disaster. And it shows no sign of abating yet. Flu viruses come and go. This one does not show any signs yet of going.
Now, how many do you trust the figures that are put out by the government?
What government?
The United States government. Or the Canadian government?
The Canadian government. I don't trust the Chinese government. But I say I'm not interested in numbers. I'm interested in the physics of the disease itself. I'm looking at the motives and the people behind it. I do not for a minute find any equation with influenza to be a defensible argument.
Oh, okay. We're going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. Felton, and he is the author of
The Host and the Parasite.
The Host and the Parasite. I was waiting for you to come back.
I'm here.
I heard the door shut, so I was.
No, it wasn't me.
Oh, okay. Anyway, The Host and the Parasite. And the websites of interest are gregselton.com and moneytreepublishing.com. And you were talking about this COVID-19.
Yeah, I don't want to get too deeply involved in this, since this is not really sort of the purpose of the show, but I just want to mention that I'm looking at this COVID-19 disease and how it's simply not going away as fast as people thought it was. I'm looking at the origin of it, and I'm going to be looking at how it came about and whether this was an accidental leak or a deliberate leak. And I haven't really quite made up my mind on that. I'm leaning toward accidental because I just cannot see any benefit for anybody leaking this terrible disease on the world population. There are no winners here. But this is what I'm working on right now, and I think this has a lot to do with I'm putting it in the context of the American-China trade dispute. I mean, what I find rather sad is that everybody's blaming China for this, and China does have some responsibility, but it wasn't China who funded it. It was the United States who sent Charles Lieber over to China, and how Charles Lieber was overseeing a lot of this work. And now he was working with Sir Zheng Li, who is the Wuhan Institute of Virology's chief coronavirus expert. So there's a lot of blame to go around here. And of course, the French were involved too, because they have a bio-level safety lab 4 in Lyon, France. And they were working with China's first biosafety lab for a facility in Wuhan, trying to get it up and running. But toward the end, they had serious reservations about its safety protocols. And of course, there's the idiocy of having such a toxic enterprise right in the heart of a city. I mean, if anybody had any brains, this would be out in the boonies somewhere, away from civilization, away from people's houses and businesses. I mean, it makes no sense to put it where it is.
Now, do you see this as a depopulation protocol?
I don't see that. At least that's nothing I've come across. I would hate to think so, but I don't really see that yet. As I say, I've only begun researching this, and so I'd like to leave that for the time being and get back to Donnie, our favorite guy here.
Yes. Let's go back to Donnie.
Yeah. What I've noticed, though, is that when you write a book like this, The Host and the Parasite, you hope that it has meaning beyond the period in which it was written, that it can serve as a guidebook for future analyses. And the one thing I notice about the degeneration of the United States now with Donald Trump, and this goes probably back to W as well, is that the United States is falling back into what I consider another Gilded Age. Now, the Gilded Age, if you remember your American history, between roughly, 1875 to 1900, more or less, there was a period by which there were a lot of forgettable presidents. There was kind of like a low intellectual period of American history where the only purpose of government was to get elected and get your friends into positions of power, like jobs for the boys, empire building. Competence was considered secondary, if at all. And during this period, except for Calvin Coolidge, my brain just shot to pieces here. Except for Grover Cleveland's two non-consecutive terms, the entire White House was a Republican bastion. And the Republicans orchestrated everything so that their friends would get jobs. Competence counted for nothing, as I said. You had two groups. You had Roscoe Conkling, who had a group that was called the Stalwarts. And you had James G. Blaine, who had a group called the Half-Breeds. And each of them managed to get their own buddies into power, like there was an oscillating interest groups. And, you know, at one point, there was one American who was promised a job, didn't get it, and was so mad that he shot President James A. Garfield. It was, I didn't get a job, I'm going to go shoot the president. And that's exactly what he did. And then Chester Arthur becomes president. But the point I want to make here is that during this time, there was very little policy making. It was essentially an intellectual torpor. People were promoted to positions of authority that weren't qualified, and Americans saw themselves lapsing into a severely dangerous position. One of the things that was severe was a lack of meat inspection. And there were lots of the severe disease that came from tainted meat demanded a response. And what I'm looking at now in the United States is such massive incompetence in government that somebody, even if it's Biden, I don't know if he's up to it. I hope he is. Somebody does something to restore some measure of competence to selections for secretaries and other lower governmental positions. Since Trump took office, I'm going to let you guess, how many people have resigned or been fired?
Oh, I have no idea.
54.
In what echelon? What?
Attorney General Jeff Sessions fired.
Okay.
Second Chief of Staff John Kelly resigned. You have James Mattis, First Secretary of Defense, resigned. Linda McMahon, First Administrator of the Small Business Administration, resigned March 29th of last year. You have other people, John Bolton, of course, the toxic John Bolton.
Right.
You would have Mick Mulvaney, March 6th this year. He was Trump's third Chief of Staff. He was fired. How do you fire Chief of Staff so fast? If you look at Reagan, you had Donald Reagan or James A. Baker III, and they were consistent in their position. There was no firing of these Chiefs of Staff. I mean, you have someone like Andrew McCabe, Trump's first Deputy Director of the FBI. He was fired. Rex Tillerson, not a bad Secretary of State. He was a decent guy. He was smart. He was fired on March 13th, 2018. He had been in office 405 days. He called the president an effing moron, and Trump fired him. And the fact is, Tillerson was right. So you go through the list of the rogues gallery of people who were appointed and fired or resigned. This is a toxic, unstable presidency. And if this is the kind of governance Americans can expect, who's going to look out for things that matter? You mentioned earlier things like the infrastructure, bridges are collapsing, roads are in disrepair. So there's just nobody running the ship. People are having little punching matches up on the wheelhouse.
And of course, this has been going on for quite some time.
It has. You're right. But it's become so obvious now that something has to be done about it. It has never been this obvious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was probably I can't remember as many people resigning or being fired as under Trump. And I don't know what Americans think of this or what they're going to do about it. But somebody, I kind of hope that history repeats itself in some way.
Well, I think he likes the word "you're fired." Wasn't that part of his
yes,
gig?
Yeah, that was
watched the program.
You're fired. It was like the intern or whatever it was. Or I don't watch Trump, but yeah, you're fired. He thought it was a big deal. Yeah, you're fired. Oh, you're fired. Yeah, that was his big shtick.
Yeah.
The Apprentice. That was what it was.
Okay.
But I mean, I'm just thinking that Americans have to wonder what the hell is going on with their country. But I want them to be aware that Trump, in as much as he is what he is not unique to the problem of neo-fascist or undemocratic government. And you're quite right to assert that this is not unique to Trump. This goes back at least to Ronald Reagan when the rot started to set in earnest. But I want to talk about a current cabinet minister. That's Betsy DeVos.
Oh, yes.
Now, this is typical of Reagan, like the Gilded Age presidents, of appointing people who are unqualified for government, but sort of side with his own biases. And she doesn't know her job. She doesn't know the history of education. She thinks that the historically black colleges and universities in America. And she said this in an interview, that where they were created as pioneers of school choice for black students. Now, why would you have a black university to be a choice for a black student? I mean, why would a black student not want to go to a so-called white university? Well, it turns out that these black universities were put in place because blacks were denied access to white universities. And this was essentially the philosophy that Booker T. Washington followed, because he was a young black reformer who believed that if the world was so prejudiced against blacks, blacks would have to do for themselves, create their own universities, their own businesses, their own agencies, that they would live in a parallel society, perhaps not as wealthy, but at least they wouldn't be victims of prejudice. Now, you can argue that this was a good or a bad idea. I'm not here to argue Washington's point of view. W.E.B. Du Bois, one of the Harlem Renaissance writers, was vigorously opposed to this, and he felt that prejudice had to be tackled head on. But for DeVos to say that black universities were bastions, were sort of the signs of choice and progression, pioneers of school choice, that's just ignorant. And it's no wonder that she was booed heavily when she gave a commencement address at a Florida university. My God, why would anybody not boo her? This is typical of Trump. Trump doesn't want anybody around him who knows what's going on, because it makes him look, I think, less competent, if that's possible. I mean, Stalin did the same thing. He fired anybody in the civil service or in government that was popular, intelligent, or had a following. Nobody could be smarter than him. And of course, Trump is a self-declared genius. Did you know that? Now, that would mean his IQ had to be above 140 or higher. And I wouldn't bet that it's probably no higher than about 115.
If that. Typical IQ is 106.
Really? Well, what's W was 91.
Really?
Yeah. That's according to one evaluation. I said, I can't speak to the methods used to test, but that's what it says here.
Okay. Between 60 and 70 is you're kind of a really an imbecile.
Well,
so 91 is within.
Well, that's like, it's average, but it's just one point away from below average.
Right.
Yeah. So the highest was Bill Clinton. He was about 160 or something. He was very smart. Clinton was a very bright man, but he
had his problems. If he was so smart, he would not have been going on the Lolita Express. He would have covered his tracks better. He wouldn't have had all of these mistresses. He wouldn't have done cocaine. The guy was a drug addict.
Bill Clinton.
Yes.
Okay. I'll take you at face value. I didn't investigate his drug habits. But just because you're smart doesn't mean you can't fool around with a lot of women. Jack Kennedy was a notorious womanizer. And, you know, people sort of dealt with it. It was sort of an accepted thing he did. Nobody made a big deal of it, but, you know, he was a womanizer. But I don't think intelligence and moral conduct are necessarily compatible. As far as the Lolita Express, that's just bad judgment. I think maybe he thought he was sort
bad
of a...
Bad judgment to have sex with children?
I think the point is that he felt that he was probably immune from observation, immune from prosecution. Nobody was going to do anything about it because he was who he is. There were so many people like Alan Dershowitz, Alan Dershbag, that was involved.
He has to pay to have sex with somebody.
Yeah, and a paper bag and a blindfold. And the thing is, there were so many important people involved. The Prince Andrew. That nobody was going to expose this because there were too many people whose reputations were at stake. Well, it turns out it did get exposed. and Clinton ended up in, you know, in hot water. But again, Clinton was a smart man, you know, technically speaking, and then Bush, George W. Bush wasn't. But the case of Trump, Trump is not smart. And he perhaps knows he's not smart, but he's afraid of people who are. Now, I'm looking at Anthony Fauci, who is the head of the coronavirus, you know, task force, or he's supposed to be. He's warning Trump that hydroxychloroquine is not a good, a good remedy for it. And Trump is overruling him. And Trump has no basis for doing that. Trump has no basis of knowledge of anything.
Well, what do you think is a good remedy for this?
I don't think there is a remedy for it, frankly. At least I haven't seen one that there is, and that's what I'm researching. But the thing is, there's no scientific evidence that hydroxychloroquine is a cure for the coronavirus or the COVID-19.
Right.
But Trump is arguing about something he knows nothing about.
Well, they used it for malaria.
Yeah, but this is not malaria.
Right.
This is a coronavirus which does not have a certain furin cleavage sites, which does not have the same sort of, has the sort of viral infectiousness that, that malaria does. It's different. And just because it works on malaria doesn't mean it'll work on anything else. It's not a one size fits all, you know, drug. But the thing is, why would Trump argue? Because Trump is a small minded, petty tyrant. And that is the way he's running his government. He thinks he's the be-all and end-all of government. He doesn't listen to people. And he's alienating anybody that could possibly be an ally. 54 people have left his government under a cloud, or they've just resigned out of frustration. Or they've been fired because they've stood up to him. If you don't want people to stand up to you, then you don't have a government of intelligent people. Even at his worst, Lyndon Johnson McCabe maintained Pierre Salinger and Bill Moyers in his inner circle because they were the ones who would give him contrarian advice. They would warn him against going into Vietnam. They would give him a complete picture. Now that he ignored them, but at least he listened to them. He didn't fire them.
All righty, we are going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Guest is Greg Felton, and he is the author of The Host and the Parasite. In Canada, now, do you have the same problem with the Jewish influence in Canada?
Oh, yes. It's terrible here. In one government some years ago, there was a group called Liberal Parliamentarians for Israel. And this happened around 2005, 2006 under the prime ministership of Paul Martin. The Israel lobby has got its hooks seriously into Canada. As a matter of fact, when I was in Ottawa promoting my book, I ran into one of the Liberal Party's chief advisors or sort of consultants, and he told me in confidence that Paul Martin lived in deathly fear of the Israel lobby. And I believe it, because the Israel lobby threatens people, it threatens their careers. For example, there was a liberal MP from Ottawa, from Ontario, called Boris Vishnevsky, and he said he had his career threatened when he came back from Lebanon and told about the truth of what he had seen. Canada is seriously under the thumb of the Israel lobby, and it's terrible. Our current prime minister is scared to death of it because he acts like a little wussified, toy soldier. Whenever the Israel lobby stamps his little feet, he sort of does whatever he has to. He's terrible. There is no courage to stand up to Israel. And in one case, in the so-called Conservative Party, we have enthusiastic supporters of Jewish fascism in Palestine. Even the New Democratic Party, which is, I guess, the closest thing you would call to a left-wing party in Canada, its leader is pro-Israel. And there's no excuse for this sort of ignorance in a national party leader. So, yeah, it's a real problem up here. We have our own analog to Alan Dershowitz, and that's Erwin Kotler. He is an allegedly a human rights lawyer and champion, but he has a conspicuous blind spot for Palestinians. And he's a big personal friend of Alan Dershowitz. And so it becomes, you can tell who's really running the show here. For example, when I was giving a lecture at the Vancouver Public Library about my book in 2008, three agencies of the Israel lobby descended on the library demanding that my talk be canceled. But I managed to talk myself into it. They could not deny me the right to speak without calling into question the library's moral right to exist. So I managed to give my speech. I had someone videotape it, which I am so glad that I did, because I have, on, if you go to my website, you'll find that I have a video of, there are what one, two, multiple, six parts of my video presentation, and collectively they've had well over 100,000 views. So my voice has got out there, and people have bought my books because of it. So it was very successful. But the Israel lobby here is really toxic. It's invisible. It is the kind of toxin that, like, for example, you talk about coronavirus being invisible. Well, the Israel lobby is just as invisible. And it's a worse virus because it infects more people than the virus.
Wow.
It's a political contagion, not a biological one.
All righty, we are at the top of the hour. We will be right back, and we'll take your calls. Be right back.
Oh, goody.
Listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
All right, welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest is Greg Felton. He is the author of The Host and the Parasite. Now, it was recently republished, because you wrote it, your first edition came out when?
2008, 2007, I forget which, but it's had two updates since then.
Okay, and the most recent update is dated what?
Oh, was this 2020, right? So I think it was August 2018, I think. Yeah, it was soon after Trump got elected, and I had written some essays and analyses of Trump and Obama, and I put together what I thought was kind of an important addendum, because the America that George W. Bush created or destroyed, depending on your point of view, was not really as obvious to some people as it ought to be. So I had to show that Obama, far from being a reformer, was a continuation of Bushian PNAC, you know, it's an overt, you know, autocracy. And then I had to show how Obama and Trump are to some extent similar and to some extent different. So I had to sort of bring it up to date. Now, if Trump gets defeated in the election this year, as I expect him to do, then I might have to go back and add something about Biden. But I don't know. Well, we'll see what happens.
Okay, I do have an email question for you. Mm-hmm. What is your source for claiming that Bush had an IQ of 91?
I have to go back that I haven't got it up on here, but I can get back to you, and you can send it to your caller a bit later, but I did have it up here, yeah.
Okay, and the average is around 100.
I don't know what the average is. Yeah. I've never had my IQ checked. Apparently I did when I was very, very young.
Well,
and my parents would never tell me the answer. And I don't know whether that was common for children not to know their IQ.
Well, they did it in schools when I was in school, in grade school, they did IQ tests.
That's probably where mine was tested, although we're probably of a similar age. So maybe when we were in school, maybe that's what we, maybe that's where it came from, because I never remember taking it. So I have to assume that that was what it is.
And I don't know that they ever told the parents. I don't know. I did find out what mine was later on.
Okay. Again, I would suggest that people not take too seriously the notion that George W. Bush had an IQ of 91. Because again, this is, as I said when I gave, this was according to the source. I'm not stating this as an absolute fact, mm-hmm. but I would state that George W. Bush's conduct was quite below what most people would expect of a president.
Well, he had an alcohol problem. He had some problems. Let me just ask this other question that this gentleman asked. Do you believe that Obama and Biden would make a better president than Trump? Obama or Biden? Or maybe a combination?
I don't like either, all three of them. I think Obama was very toxic in his own way. He gave a statement some time ago when he was talking about why he was being opposed. He called himself a liberal Jew. And that's how he identified himself when he was running for office. I think Obama is a very polite, intelligent, well-spoken, articulate man. But he's just as bad for America as Trump is. The only thing I would say he would probably do better is that he wouldn't stack the Supreme Court with dangerously right-wing people like Gorsuch or Clarence Thomas. But I don't know. I would say that Biden is not qualified to run for president. I think he's terrible. But whether when the election comes, it'll be probably academic, because people will have to decide whether or not Trump deserves a second term, despite his numerous unspeakable failings. I don't think there's anybody to vote for. I would probably hold my nose and vote for Biden only because Trump is dangerously out of control.
Yeah, it's going to be quite an interesting situation. We do have some callers. Chance mm-hmm. in West Virginia. Chance?
Yes. Hello, Deanna. Hello, Mr. Felton. Mr. Felton, for myself, it's been a very interesting and enlightening 2 hours. You made me reevaluate a lot of my opinions, sir, and I appreciate that. The question I have for you, Mr. Felton, is I've heard your name somewhere. Your name is familiar. Were any of your other books advertised in the American Free Press by any chance?
Yes, they were.
Because I'm interested in buying them. Could you wrap up a couple of the titles, how to start with them?
Yeah, the first title is called The Host of the Parasite, How Israel's Fifth Column Consumed America. And the second book is called Exploding Middle East Myths. And that is a collection of essays that I wrote that looks at Israel and the corrupting influence on the media and American politics in a different categories. For example, there's the one about, I have a look at, let me just call up my set my book here for a second. It has to do with, say, Palestine and the
right.
and how Israel has destroyed the Palestinian state and how the Western world is complicit in this as well.
Right. And, now, Mr. Felton, you wrote previous books also, haven't you, I believe?
No, I there was a book title, but I objected to the way it was edited and I distanced myself from it, and I don't acknowledge it. The only two books that I will say that I am an author of is The Host and the Parasite and Exploding Middle East Myths.
Okay, thank you, sir. I will make sure to go out and pick them up and read them. You're a very knowledgeable guest, and I thank you. Thank you, Mr. Felton. Thank you, Diana, for taking my call.
Diana. Okay.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Chance. All righty. We have next Thomas in Florida. Thomas?
Hello.
Yes, Thomas.
Yes. Very interesting, all the different information. But I think what we need to basically understand is the most imperative thing that we're doing here is we need to dismantle the power structure that seems to engulf the entire planet. And, of course, specifically our country and, for Mr. Felton, Canada. And I think that basically we've got to distill it down to basically two things. And I hate to be, sound pompous here, but this is what I actually believe. Not necessarily in the order, but number one, we actually have to break the myth of the Holocaust. That basically is the linchpin of the power of Israel and the Zionists. If you get down to the absurdity of it all, they've actually built these things called Holocaust memorials, which I basically say are temples that they've built to the myth that they've shoved down all our throats. If that was to become publicly known, I think you'd see an incredible unraveling of what we're all suffering under, all that you're talking about today. The second thing that has to be known, and this particular subject would unite everybody on the planet, and it's got to do with the pedophilia. I don't know if Mr. Felton understands or believes or knows anything about it, but I've come to believe that it truly does exist. And it's not just pedophilia. That's kind of a light term. I do believe that they are involved in child sacrifices. I do believe they're involved in the drinking of adrenochrome, which is basically children's blood. Basically heightened through terrorizing him. I mean, I don't know if he's ever gone there. He probably thinks I'm a nut. He should explore it further. That particular subject in and of itself would unite every decent person on the planet, regardless of where they live or what language they speak. If they realized this was going on, everybody would be on the same page. It's the only subject that we'd all be on the same page. So I figure it's very, very, very important that it should be spread, and everybody should know about it. I would like to give you some examples.
Okay, I think what I'd like to address one thing first of all about the Holocaust. Yeah. You're deadly correct. Very true. The Holocaust was essentially a fabrication, at least as far as the 6 million figure goes. I mean, it's well known that the 6 million figure was around for about 45 years before World War II ended. It had been part of Zionist propaganda for decades. And the New York Times, for example, as well as the American Hebrew, had dozens of stories about Jews, dead or dying Jews, whether from Poland, from Romania, Russia, Ukraine. It had been a standard trope. And the number itself is apocryphal. It comes from Jewish religious writings of about, 2,000 years ago, more or less. The problem, though, is that this is such a fiction that has been beaten into the culture of the world that would be a very difficult thing to do. But you are right, it must be done. The cult of the Holocaust must be broken. And once that happens, the rhetorical defense for the state of Israel goes with it. Because everything that is justified in the name of Israel goes back to the cult of the persecution under Hitler, that the whole world is perpetually guilty of anti-Jewish prejudice. There's no way the world can ever rid itself of that taint. But this is the one thing that I've written about as well. And I hope that people have the courage to do so. And perhaps the virus is going to have such an effect that people will no longer be afraid to speak out about it because there are too many other problems going on. I hope people do speak out about it. But I do know from other people's experience here in Canada that to state the truth of the Holocaust or the, to expose the fiction of it, invites retribution from the official intellectual Gestapo that's in the country, and people can lose their jobs. As far as child sacrifice, I don't want to go there. I don't have any evidence for this. I find that it seems to be so extreme as to be slightly absurd. I cannot speak to your evidence about this. I would have to see definitive proof. I don't find that it helps with an argument based on political necessity, because this appeals to people's emotions, and people, I think, might overreact to it, and I just don't know whether it's useful.
Right.
I think it's ironic, though, that the absolute proof positive that the Holocaust did not occur was proven by Ernst Zundel in a trial that actually occurred in Canada. Now, he lost the first trial, and then upon appeal, he literally got the foremost authority of the Holocaust on the stand, and basically his attorneys shredded the guy, okay? So if you can't say that it wasn't proven in a court of law, well, you have to look at the Ernst Zundel trial, and that's actually got to be the definitive. In other words, there's no arguing other than under very, very controlled circumstances. Your average, you know, Jew will like to, you know, spit, bite, scream, scratch. You can't do that. You have to answer the questions, or you have to shut up. You have to produce your evidence, or you have to shut up. Ernst Zundel won that trial. Then he was abducted out of Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, because it could not be tolerated by the powers that be. But what I'd like to move on to the pedophilia thing. Listen,
no, actually, I would like not to get involved with this, because this is going to get into an area about which I have no personal knowledge, and I cannot really speak to it.
Well, for listeners, so, I'd like to explain this if Deanna would let me do it. We're older. We don't know much about what younger people think and what they do because of our age. Okay. There was a group called Audio Slave.
Thomas, we could probably talk about this at another time, because we do have other callers on the line. And there's been enough in the news lately about the subject that people are reading about it, and with the Epstein situation and the Lolita Express and whatnot. And that's probably as much as we'd like to cover today.
Okay, I'd like to explain something to you later if I could, because it's very pertinent to what's going on. Okay,
so
is there any way to reach you?
You have my email, Deanna@spingola.email. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas. Okay, let's go on to Ed in Utah.
Yeah, Deanna, thanks a lot. This is a very interesting conversation, Mr. Feldman. By the way, that last caller, very intelligent, Thomas. He's brought a lot to the table, as he usually does. And it does need to be investigated, all of it. In fact, that's why General Flynn is still wrongly under siege by the federal government. He's the one, if you recall, Deanna, that brought up Pizzagate. They couldn't have that. He started the chant, lock her up, because of the Clinton crime family, the Clintonistas involved in the Lyota Express. But you, Mr. Feldman, your analysis of Zio-politics, I believe, is spot on. There's not a lot I disagree with you there. I totally disagree with you on your analysis of Donald J. Trump. Not that he is our savior, per se. But so some things that you go on, like maybe you're devoid of understanding in his background. A young Donald Trump in his late 30s, businessman Donald Trump, actually took out a full-page ad, Mr. Feldman, back in the mid-70s, very astutely warning Mr. Nixon, Mr. President, do not go to China. You're going to be used as a pawn in the game. Stay out of China. Don't be used like that, Mr. Nixon. Mr. Nixon, unfortunately, did not take that advice, and it led to the opening up of China, and which was, of course, many Zionist dreams. Saul Eisenberg, who Michael Piper talked about in Final Judgment, where he cracked the John F. Kennedy case, brought up Saul Eisenberg, who was within China, trying to propel China onto the world using their cheap labor base, et cetera, et cetera. But back to the point, Donald Trump, whether he knew all that is not important. He knew about the dangers of so-called free trade. He knew that as a young businessman. So, Mr. Feldman, in that regard, I do believe you sell him short. And also, look at some of his picks. Look at Mr. Flynn. Look at Roger Stone. Not perfect, but the man was wrongly put away wrongly. And I believe in him in Donald Trump commuting his sentence. Did he pick a lot of Zionists and deep state swamp creatures? Yes, he did. Again, he's no saint as such, but he look what he's not done, Mr. Feltman. There's been no major war in the Middle East for these Zionist war hawks. He hasn't done it. A lot of symbolism.
Ed, yep. He came into office in January of 2017. In April, he bombed Syria. And
the tarmac.
And just recently, he bombed their wheat fields, so they're starving, okay? So,
The Syrian bombing was he hit the tarmac. I started to say symbolism. Like the moving of, Tel Aviv, U.S. Embassy. These symbolic things are bad, and I'm with you both on that. However, when he bombed Syria, he hit the tarmac, and he also gave them warning so that Bashar al-Assad could move stuff out. The other thing is his mishandling of his friendship, his out-and-out good friendship for good reason with Vladimir Putin. This is one of the reasons for Russiagate, to make it toxic to be friends like he announced he was going to be with the new nationalist leader of nationalist Russia, as opposed to when the left did love Russia when they were Soviet under the communist Jews. So...
Can I jump in here for a sec? First of all, as far as Trump goes, his bombing of Syria in consecutive Aprils in 2017 and 2018 was entirely unnecessary. This was pushed on him by the deep state swamp critters, and the only time the press ever said anything good about Trump until that time is when he started bombing. So if America ain't killing, the media ain't happy. Trump had no business bombing Syria.
I have to take a quick break. Ed, if you want to stay over, we'll be right back in 3 minutes.
It starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead. To change the bad to good. To live in harmony.
All righty, we are back. And our guest is Greg Felton. He is the author of The Host and the Parasite. And we have Ed on the phone.
Can I mention one thing first? Sure. Ed mentioned about Nixon and China. Of course, as everybody knows, when Nixon was president, China was called Red China, and Mao Zedong was still the head of the country. And America threw its weight behind Taiwan, which was led by the descendants of Chiang Kai-shek. But eventually China would have to be reckoned with because China is just too big to be ignored. And the diplomacy that Nixon engaged to recognize China, I think, was one of the achievements of his presidency. Now, because he opened up China to American business, it was up to American business to decide, how to deal with that. Now, Nixon can't be held responsible for the hundreds upon hundreds of businesses that shipped American jobs overseas to take advantage of cheap Chinese labor. Eventually, China would have had to have been dealt with, because you can't ignore something that big for so long. And as diplomacy goes, it was extremely successful, and I think Nixon deserves credit for that. As far as Trump goes, warning Nixon, what was Trump's basis for that? I mean, Trump has no knowledge of China. He has no understanding of economics, international trade. I mean, Trump really doesn't have much of a knowledge of anything. He has no store of education or experience to offer an informed opinion about politics. All he can do is throw out his visceral opinion. I remember when it was attacking Barack Obama, he warned, don't go to Syria, don't bomb Syria, Mr. President. That would be a very bad thing, almost in those words. So what does Trump do when he gets elected? Kaboom, he bombs Syria twice. So even if Trump does know what to do, the right thing to do, there's no guarantee he will do it.
Ed, your response?
Okay, my response. I did have that final point that you held me over for, but since you went back to Red China, let's go there. I do not blame Nixon as such. It was, like I said, the internationalists, the Zionists that were pushing it. what Donald Trump was trying to warn him in that full-page ad that he took out in the New York Times was not to be a pawn in the game. That's what I said. Therefore, it was a misstep in that regard. Nixon, no, he regretted that. He told his daughter on his deathbed he regretted going to China. So Donald Trump was right. Donald Trump sell him short on that. His father was a very big political as well. His father, and I'm not part of the John Birch Society, but briefly, it's reported he was part of that. So he was looking at that time, that was the only organization speaking out against internationalism, was the John Birch Society, which started in Massachusetts. So I did want to put that to rest, that Nixon was used by the internationalists. He thought he was doing good. But China became a very big menace. As I told you, Shaul Eisenberg, the international Jew, as Michael Piper exposed in Final Judgment, the book, that he was over there working China and financing China. And that's why China blew up the bomb 1 year after the killing of Kennedy, because it was a proxy Israeli test of the bomb. China was now its proxy. But that's what I have to say about China. I was trying to go on to my final point, and I'll let you guys go, was on the overall of Trump. I want a second term. Then I might join you, Mr. Feldman, in saying Trump this, Trump that. But you've had a lot of visceral attacks on him. The fact is, there's been very little move on gun control. That would not be the case with a mindless Biden, who is a very hostile man, who did business in China, by the way. You would have a guy in many accounts who has said things, I won't use the kind of language he has whispered in the ear, picked up by microphone to young 13-year-old girls. This man could not get his hands off of Jeff Sessions' granddaughters. This man has no business anywhere near the back door of the White House, Mr. Feldman. And you seem from a very Canadian CBC type of mainstream news. I could get what you're saying from CNN.
Let me explain. That is patently ridiculous. I have no use for CNN. Just because I disagree with you doesn't mean I'm some sort of politically correct pundit. I'm probably more right-wing than you think I am. The point is that Donald Trump has no capacity for mature, rational thought. His language depicts that of a schoolyard bully of about 10 years old. Trump cannot articulate a coherent idea. He has made so many misstatements of fact that one has to question his ability to govern. I don't know whether you might think that Trump guessed right in the mid-70s about China, but that doesn't really matter. The man in power now is manifestly incompetent. He's hostile, he's divisive, he is destroying whatever is left of the Republican Party. The Republicans and the Trump-publicans have to sort themselves out. And I don't know if the Republican Party can survive this. Now, as far as being in Canada goes, I'm just as qualified to look at American politics as any American is. And I would submit that maybe that my bias is somewhat less visceral than yours. But as far as Saul, whatever his name is, I cannot accept without some serious investigation that the opening up of China was a Zionist conspiracy. I find that to be somewhat a little bit bizarre. I mean, if anybody was a president in 1972, Trump, at least sort of, Nixon, before 72, I think, Nixon would have had to do something, because the anti-communist rhetoric was running kind of stale, and something had to be done. So I don't see this as a Zionist mentality. There are a lot of things he did that were very bad. Edgar Kaiser got him to set up these HMO-type things for Americans to get health insurance, and these were designed not to help the American public, but to make money for lots of corporations. That was rather unfortunate. That was completely unacceptable. But foreign policy-wise, Nixon wasn't bad.
All righty. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ed.
Evil man.
Oh, please, go away.
Okay, we do need to move on because we have another caller. But thank you, Ed, for sharing your thoughts. Let's take Richard in Alabama. Richard?
Am I on?
Yes, you are.
Okay. I can see the demise of this country mainly caused by the rapid reduction in the white population. and the rapid increase in the African population. And we see all during this so-called civil rights era, the Jewish judges have been running Alabama and most of the old Confederacy by court order, and they've rearranged the welfare system and the housing system to reward African babies and provide nothing for white babies except the greater chance of being arrested and put into foster homes.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, the Jews are ruining this country through courts. They manipulate the courts.
Well, I don't know if I can agree with that at all. That's a rather biased statement. And I would suggest that on the Supreme Court of the United States, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is one of the few voices of reason, and she happens to be Jewish. So I think categorical blanket condemnation of Jews gets us nowhere. Because there are Jews who are very intelligent and they're supportive of the United States, and I just don't think that you can reduce America's problem to racial prejudice and black births versus white births. I just don't know if that's a useful way to go, because you can't prove anything. And besides which, it's nothing about which I have written.
Well, demographics are obvious.
No, they're not. No, that's silly. No, but you can't fight demographics. What are you going to do, say, force sterilization of blacks? Compel white women to have 2.5 children per family? I mean, what are you going to do? You can't do anything about it. Demographics are just demographics. It's not a policy issue.
So it's just God's will or something?
God has nothing to do with it. This is politics. People will have children if they want to have children. There was a horrible man in Canada named Mark Stein, a Zionist, who was saying that the one example of Arab terrorism was having children. Now, this is an example of Arab terrorism was having, the fact that populating the world with Arab children was terroristic. That's just plain prejudice. Mm-hmm. And Mark Stein should be ashamed of himself. But because he's a Zionist Jew, he has no shame.
But it's obvious to you, isn't it?
No,
isn't it obvious that Africans have a right to move to all the formerly white countries? And the whites don't have any right to move to an African country. We'll never get citizenship in the Congo. They'll never allow it.
You want citizenship in the Congo? I don't think anybody wants to go to the Congo for citizenship. I will grant you one thing, that prejudice, that overcompensating for historical injustices has made prejudice against Caucasian Americans legitimate. And the people who are Caucasian do not have the same rights of appeal and protest as others. I will grant you that that is true. But I'm not going to reduce America's politics to racial stereotypes. That just doesn't get us anywhere.
Right. All righty, but thank you, Richard, for your phone call. Take care. Okay, let's take Nancy in California. Nancy?
I happen to agree with Ed. And I appreciate everything he said.
Okay, thank you.
I think Trump has done a lot of good for our country. And
such
he's
as?
Not an intellectual snob. Well, did he not defund the UN?
Well, is that a good thing or a bad thing? That doesn't help America. How does that help the United States?
Are you for the UN?
I'm aware. Oh, yes, I'm very well aware. I'm well aware of what the United Nations is.
No, I'm asking, are you in support of the United Nations?
I have very little use for the United Nations, but Donald Trump's under defunding of the World Health Organization does not help the United States.
Well, he actually...
Yes, it does. We don't have to give them money, for goodness sakes. We have debt here. Not giving them money is helpful to the United States. I can't believe you would say that.
Well, how could... Do you have any idea how much debt the United States has? And what?
I don't care. Just because we have a lot of debt doesn't mean that the debt that he... Or the money that he is giving is not substantial or doesn't mean anything. He's making an effort. You're an intellectual snob, Mr. Felton.
No. No, I'm just educated. I mean, if you look at the United States debt is so high that the gross domestic product cannot pay it off, cannot pay the interest on it. Giving a few million dollars to the World Health Organization was a very defensible, very simple thing to do. I mean, how much money does the United States throw at the Pentagon for wasteful expenditures? The Pentagon is the biggest money sink in the United States, and not all of it is necessary. The World Health Organization putting up with some UN organizations have value, like UNCTAD, UNRWA, UNICEF, the WHO, the World Court. These things deserve to be supported. And if the United States at one time, which was a defender in support of the United Nations, it has to justify why it's now changed its mind. And the only reason to do that is Donald Trump is a petty little tyrant who doesn't like what the World Health Organization said. This is not a money issue. You can't reduce this to a few cents on the dollar.
He took the money from the World Health Organization and gave it to Bill Gates and Gavi. So it was just, and the other thing too is that the recent bill that Congress just put through gave a whole bunch of money to the military which is not appropriate to fund the military and keep giving them money and to keep bombing other countries is not my idea of a good thing to be doing. So I appreciate your thoughts, so Nancy, but check into that about Bill Gates and Gavi. Okay, let's take Art in Philly. Art?
Hello, Deanna, and hello, Felton. Thank you for the time to talk. Good. So I wrote a website called NoPlaceForCorruption.com, and one thing you were mentioning about Reagan, there was a book called Dark Victory by Modelo that showed Reagan's power came up through the Brafman Crime Syndicate, which is also the power broker for CNN and Justin Trudeau. Okay? That's also the same power brokers that control DuPont, which in effect controls Biden, okay? So to say we have a good choice, I'd say we really got poor leadership on both sides. So if you're asking on a scale of 1 to 10, maybe Trump is a bad 5 and Biden's a bad 10. Neither one of them's good for this country as far as leadership goes, as far as I see it.
You're right, perfectly right. They're both horrible selections, but the problem is the horrible selection is an example of just how the political parties in the United States have been hollowed out by agencies that are utterly undemocratic. I mean,
correct.
To all intents and purposes, America is a one-party state. You have the party with the capital D and a party with a capital R, but there are really very little differences between them. Both of them have a vested interest in preventing reform from doing anything to stop their further exploitative political control over the country. They both want to make sure Israel's interests come first, and they all want to keep corporations from having to pay people fair wages. And right now, America, as I say, is ungovernable because there's no ability to fight through the infrastructure that prevents people like Bernie Sanders from coming to power and doing the right thing.
Well, if you're looking at that, the real power structure comes from the Federal Reserve Bank, and you can trace that all the way back.
Yeah.
You can trace that to the Schiff family, and I actually trace that the Schiff basically goes into Kuhn & Loeb, Mercer & Shearson, which then became Blackstone for Steven Schwarzman out of Edmonton, Pennsylvania, southeastern Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. There's a big problem with organized crime in the Jewish community here. As a matter of fact, one of the ones that came from here was the Walter Annenberg, whose father was Moses, who worked with Capone up in the National Crime Syndicate, running the race wire. They were also the power brokers who brought Obama to power. And who was with Obama? Biden. So you can see the direct connections to the Annenberg Crime Syndicate, which were the people directly behind the JFK assassination. You can see the rise of power through Nixon, and the same way you can see that Sheldon Adelson rose to power after 9/11 through the Trump family. So we can see both sides.
That's a fascinating history that I had never heard of, that particular history, and I would like to look into that, the Annenberg Crime Syndicate. I do know that the Jewish crime syndicates were all very powerful. You have Meyer Lansky, you had Mickey Cohen, and a whole bunch of others. And Cohen, of course, was Trump's mentor. But as far as the Jews go, I think it's useful to show that the Zionist Jews are different from non-Zionist Jews. If we can make that distinction, the difficulty a lot of people have is using the term Jew as a blanket term of condemnation. And unfortunately, that plays into the victim culture.
Well said. The big problem is with organized crime that when they took down John Gotti, the Italian mafia, Sicilian mafia, then basically fell out of power. And then the Cosa Nostra side of organized crime, both of which existed all back in the 20s, now is the dominant force in power. But the Cosa Nostra side also controls the Federal Reserve Bank, and that's what's making them so dangerous, not only to us, but to the world. With respect to the UN, the most important thing the UN does is the UN Security Council. And you know what the function of that is, right?
Yeah, the UN Security Council was supposed to help prevent war. Unfortunately, it has very rarely operated the way it's supposed to. And it
actually
ended up becoming a brickbat for the United States and Israel.
The UN Security Council is the last resort before the nuclear powers go and start a nuclear war with each other. So in that respect, that is one function of the UN that has worked to prevent the world from being blown up.
I would suggest you're quite right about that. But I would say that the great vaunted promise of the UN to prevent world war, to prevent violence, has failed. Because it was the United Nations that sanctified the no-fly zones over Iraq and has been bullied and pushed around by the United States. And I think that the Security Council, to the extent that you are quite right, that it has done something to attenuate the excesses of nuclear power hostility, it must be considered an objective failure, given the promise with which it started in the San Francisco conference of 1945.
Right. Okay, that's fair enough. And actually, be looking forward to see what you have written in the future.
Thank you.
My personal view is that given that we have two poor choices, the least poor of the two is what the Trump administration is doing. But I have to agree with you that neither one of them is that good for the country.
No, and I think that if ever a third-party candidate had a half-assed chance of winning, it would be this year. But I don't know if we have a third-party candidate. And traditionally, they have not fared well. The last time one did so well was Theodore Roosevelt in the 1912 election. And, you know, but I don't know. But I feel sorry for Americans.
Well, I feel sorry for Canada, with Trudeau controlled by the Brothman Syndicate. They also run CNN.
Trudeau is he's a nice guy, but he's too much of a wuss to be a prime minister. He's easily manipulated. He has no real job experience. He's a mannequin. He's a person who kisses ass of the interest groups. He tries to come across as such a fair-minded democratic boy, but he really is manifestly incompetent. But I would say that with respect to the COVID-19 disaster, our federal policy has been better than that in the United States.
The COVID-19 policy is a disaster. And really what it shows is the poor leadership in both sides of the parties. Okay.
Yeah, and I think you're perfectly correct about that.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All righty. Let's see, do we have any other callers? Nope, no other callers. Okay, do you want to respond to anything that anybody said?
Not really, except I find it rather sad that in matters of America's future, that a lot of it boils down to racial prejudice. And I just don't see that there is any merit in trying to separate white victim culture from this and saying, oh, the whites are under attack, blah, blah. Now, a lot of Caucasians might feel that, and there is a legitimate argument that pandering to interest groups is undermining the cohesion of America. But at some point, it becomes a little bit self-indulgent, and it becomes, frankly, distasteful.
Another question from email. What do you think about the Black Lives Matter? That was brought up.
Yeah. Black Lives Matter started out as a recent response to the gratuitous killing of blacks under the cover of law by white policemen. However, it has mutated into yet another political pressure group, and Black Lives Matter is more of a problem now than it is a benefit. What I find disturbing is that the language of Black Lives Matter is simply arrogant, as if to say that Black Lives Matter, well, of course they do. Everybody's life matters. That's not special. But when people appropriate the language and they appropriate slogans for self-serving purposes, then it becomes toxic. And then people who want to criticize them are put in the position of being on the defensive. What this does is it moralizes politics and makes rational discussion impossible. So I do not like Black Lives Matter. I see very little use for it. And I would hope that people... I'll tell you what's interesting. I don't know if you've ever seen the television series Bosch, starring Titus Welliver. It's a very good series about life in the Hollywood division of Los Angeles Police Department and the race relations that go on between the black community and many white cops. Now, admittedly, it's not good. There's a lot of prejudice within the police department. However, there's a trial going on in this particular season of a white cop who is alleged to have shot a very prominent black attorney. And the protest movements led by one black woman about trying to get justice for the blacks is so irritating and annoying that it serves no purpose other than to alienate anybody that would want to side with them. Just by chanting a slogan or simply protesting is not an effective way to bring about political reform. And what's interesting about Black Lives Matter is that the vast majority of these people aren't even black. They're only about 40% of the pop, 40% of them are blacks. The rest of them are Caucasians who are indulging their sense of white liberal guilt and becoming so almost more militant than the blacks are. And that's extremely disturbing. Now, I would rather, you know, it's hard to tell blacks to be reasonable because it's not my place to do so. And I know that the prejudice toward blacks is severe in America, and it's been that way since the Constitution was written. But to use Black Lives Matter as simply a brickbat with which to bludgeon the establishment over the head is counterproductive, and it calls into question the morality of the blacks themselves. In the southern states, it was commonplace for a while for whites to lynch blacks just because they could, on the least provocation, and lynch laws were one of the most repugnant.
Oh, absolutely.
Aspects. But now we have a scenario where, to a large extent, Black Lives Matter and Antifa and other sort of militant political organizations are engaging in almost the same thing, not to the extent of actually killing people, but by prejudicing people before any issue can be discussed properly. In the Charlottesville protests over the Robert E. Lee statue, the violence was started by Black Lives Matter and Antifa. It was not the white nationalists, who, of course, may be politically repugnant, but you don't have to like them. But by the same token, you don't have to provoke them with violence, which is what happened. So when you have language that is so politicized and moralized, like Black Lives Matter, Antifa, was, and so forth, it shows that a certain segment of society has appropriated for itself the cloak of victimhood. And that essentially insulates them from having to be accountable for what they say. And that is when we end up with riots. Because Black Lives Matter is just as much a problem for the United States as the prejudice that gave rise to it. We have to stop this. We have to stop dividing America into moral battlegrounds, and Black Lives Matter has to go by the boards. It's like this horrible Me Too hashtag about sexual assault. No one's going to defend sexual assault at all. That's patently ridiculous. But this Me Too is sort of politicizing the entire culture where it is impossible to debate sexual relations without having to defend oneself right out of the gate. I mean, we have to stop using Twitter. We have to stop using the electronic media to politicize, radicalize, and otherwise de-intellectualize policy decisions and policy discussions. Right now, there's between the two extremes, there's such a chasm in the middle where reason ought to survive, but it doesn't. It falls through the cracks.
Hey. All righty, we are going to a quick 3-minute break. We'll be right back. All right, we are back with our guest today, Greg Felton. And we do have one last caller from California, Lenny, in California.
Yes. I've listened to the entire program, and I am very impressed with your guest, Diana, and his analogy, his former analogy of Black Lives Matter. I find no fault with it, okay? And I think he's spot on with it. And this has been infiltrated and controlled for the purpose of getting a different result that was meant. I found it interesting that after the testifying before Congress the other day, the hearing before Congress the other day, that Jeff Bezos of Amazon made a statement of the effect that what we need here is a race reckoning, as if he's willing to go out and fight a race war. Or is he willing to, or is he expecting someone else to go out and fight it for him? So I just found that to be very interesting. Now, as far as the presidents are concerned, to me, and as far as I'm concerned, Barack Obama was the worst. He came in a trifecta of colors that never helped anyone, less than on the blacks. And I agree with you, sir. I read exactly when he said that he considered himself a liberal Jew. Now, here's a man who was brought into existence with the name that rhymed with Osama. Okay, mm-hmm. And it was too far fetched for that to happen. And he could become president of the United States. Now, I just have one problem with what you said, and that is bad judgment on Bill Clinton, being on the Lolita Express. He was there on there 23 times. Sir, with all due respect, that's a whole lot of bad judgment.
Okay, fair enough. I want to make sure that I wasn't trying to diminish his conduct. I was merely reacting to the, excuse me, the notion of about intellectual IQ. So I do apologize if that was misconstrued. But as far as Bezos, I'm going to look into that because that's very interesting. I do find groups like BLM, they get co-opted. They get turned into brickbats for other agencies. It's very hard to control the organization or the membership. This is what happened to Occupy Wall Street. Occupy Wall Street was infiltrated and destroyed. And BLM is finding itself going the same way, I think.
Yes, just what he just Google the term race reckoning Jeff Bezos and it should come up. But take a look at him. Here's a guy who looked like at the last fight he had was trying to open up a bag of marshmallows. You really think he's gonna go out and fight anything?
I don't know. That's a very good point. I'm glad you made it.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call, Dana.
Okay, thank you, Lenny.
Before we go, Deanna, I was wondering if I could might make one comment about my other book, Exploding Middle East Myths,
sure,
which we haven't talked a little bit about. The book itself is a group of essays that I wrote over a period of a time when I was an opinion writer and a freelance writer. And it looks at the certain lies pertaining to Israel and the Middle East in the various categories. Part of it is to do with the history of Zionism and how the ideology came about. And attacks upon Palestine. This is some of the historical essays that I write about. I look at Israeli propaganda and my favorite chapters where it has to do with the media co-optation of the American media and how Hasbarats, which is a term that I coined, I hope, people who spout Hasbara, which is propaganda, do so, and the Quislings or the betrayers of the American trust or the media allow themselves to be used in that regard.
Right.
I have a few satires as well. I urge people to get it. It's still quite relevant to the modern era.
Okay, Greg, we're run out of time.
Yeah, I can hear the music.
Okay, thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you, Deanna.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.